Disc 8.
In the last cage, the bearded man sank back onto his haunches and, covering his mouth with the tail of his shirt, breathed through the fabric. One of the scientists brought over a Sony camera attached to a tripod and began filming the prisoner. Another scientist checked the time on his wristwatch, noted it on his clipboard, then removed the cover on the petri dish and stepped away from the cage. Martin's thoughts went back to the trial that had landed him and the girl in the monkey cages. The court-martial, the warlord's term for the proceedings, had started after the lunch break and lasted 20 minutes. Presiding from the makeshift throne on the stage of the auditorium, Hamlet had acted as prosecutor and judge. Martin, his wrists secured with the dog's leash, had been charged with both high and low treason. Almaghul, accused of aiding and abetting, had stood behind Martin, nervously whispering translations in his ear. Hamlet had opened the proceedings by announcing that he was absolutely convinced of the guilt of the accused, that the sole purpose of the court-martial was to determine the degree of guilt and eventually the appropriate punishment. Guilty of what? Martin had asked after pleading innocent to the formal charge of high and low treason.
Guilty of working for a foreign intelligence agency, Hamlet had shot back. Guilty of trying to steal Russia's biowarfare secrets.
My only interest, Martin had had Almaghul say, is to interview Samat Ugurgilov. And he had explained about Samat's humanitarian quest, repatriating to a village in Lithuania the bones of St. Gediman in order to obtain the sacred Torah scrolls and bring them to Israel.
And where?
Hamlet inquired, leaning forward, cocking his big head so as to better catch Martin's response.
Would Samat find the bones of St. Gediman?
I was told he'd traced them to a small Orthodox church near the city of Cordoba in Argentina.
And what?
The warlord continued, his short feet dancing on the ammunition box.
Would Samat offer the Argentines in return for the bones of the saint?
Martin realized he'd reached the minefield.
I have no idea, he replied. That's one of the questions I wanted to ask Samat.
At which point Hamlet launched into a tirade so fierce that Almaghul had all to do to keep up with him.
He says you know very well what Samat would trade, otherwise you would not have come to this island. He says the Russian nuclear arsenal will become obsolete in 10 years' time, and the Americans will rule Russia unless Samat is able to perfect bioweapons to counter the American threat. He says bioweapons are the only cost-efficient answer to Russia's problem. He says it costs $2 million to kill half the population of 1 square kilometer with missiles loaded with conventional warheads, $80,000 with a nuclear weapon, $600 with a chemical weapon, and $1 with a bioweapon. Vozrozhdeniye Island, he reminds you, was once the center of bioweapon research for the Soviet Union. Under Samat's direction and with Samat's financial backing, Vozrozhdeniye is once again developing a bio-arsenal that will save Russia from American domination.
Hamlet collapsed back into the throne. One of the white-coated scientists brought over a porcelain basin filled with water smelling of disinfectant, and the warlord wrang out the sponge in it and mopped his feverish brow. Martin said, very quietly, "Are you suggesting that Samat gave bioweapon seed stock to the Argentinians in exchange for the bones of the saint?"
"That is not what I am suggesting,"
the warlord groaned when he heard Almaghul's translation.
"Is that what I am suggesting?"
he asked the scientists in lab coats.
"Nyet, nyet,"
they responded in a discordant chorus.
"There is the proof,"
Hamlet cried, waving toward the scientists as if they were his star witnesses. "Then what are you suggesting?" Martin had Almaghul ask.
"Who is on trial here? You or me?"
the warlord retorted furiously.
"I am not suggesting Samat provided the Argentinian military with bioweapons. I am also not suggesting that he provided them with the orbits of American spy satellites. That rumor is without substance. It is a fact of life, as any idiot knows, that to get high-quality photographs, the spy satellites are obliged to orbit Earth at low altitudes, circling the planet in a polar orbit every 90 minutes. It is a fact of life that they are over any one point on the Earth's surface for only a few minutes. If you know when one of the satellites is due overhead, you can suspend operations you do not want the Americans to photograph. India and Pakistan have been doing this for years. So has Iraq. From whence comes the rumor that it is from Saddam Hussein in Iraq that Samat obtained the American satellite orbits that he traded to the Argentines for the bones of the saint?"
It dawned on Martin that Hamlet and the people around him were stark raving mad. characters that Alice might have come across when she fell down the rabbit hole. He decided it was in his interests to humor the mad warlord. And what in the world could Samat have given to Saddam Hussein in return for the orbits? Almaghul whispered, "It is perilous to know the answer." But Martin, drunk on state secrets, ordered her to translate the question. Hamlet drew his navy revolver from its holster and spun the chamber, sending the ticking sound reverberating through the auditorium. Then he raised the revolver and sighted on Martin's head and said, "Bang, bang, you are extinguished!" He laughed at his little joke, and the others in the auditorium laughed with him, albeit somewhat anxiously, so it seemed to Martin. After a moment, Hamlet said,
"If Samat had wanted to go down that path, he could have traded to Saddam Hussein anthrax spores and hemorrhagic seed viruses that were harvested here on the island in exchange for the orbits."
The warlord lifted the goggles off of his eyes and scratched thoughtfully at the side of his bulbous nose with the barrel of the revolver. A stunted grin materialized on his thick lips.
"He could have traded the orbits for the bones of the saint, and the bones of the saint for the Torah scrolls. But it goes without saying, none of this actually happened."
Hamlet, tired of the game, gaveled the butt of his revolver down on the arm of the throne.
"You and the girl are guilty as charged and sentenced to the monkey cages, to be used as guinea pigs in our experiments. Case closed, trial over, court adjourned."
The groaning of the giant scavenger in the last cage shook Martin out of his reverie. Almaghul, sitting on the icy floor with her back to the bars in the cage next to Martin, buried her head between her knees. Her body shook with silent sobs. Martin reached through the bars to touch her shoulder.
"I recognize the men in the cages," the girl whispered hoarsely. "They are the ones missing from Nukus. We are all surely going to die like my father and my sister," she added. "They have already killed 6 scavengers from Nukus and thrown their bones to the flamingos. The worst part is that I have no sister to take my name."
In the last cage, the giant scavenger pitched forward onto his knees, with his head touching the ground, and then rolled onto his side. The scientist filming the test called to the 2 others in Russian to come over and look. The man with the clipboard produced a large skeleton key and opened the padlock on the monkey cage, and the 3 Russians in lab coats, still wearing their gas masks, ducked inside and crouched around the body. One of them raised the scavenger's limp wrist and let it flop back again. "Constantine will be extremely pleased with his Ebola," he started to say, when the giant scavenger, bellowing with a primitive furor, sprang to life and began shattering the gas masks and the facial bones of the scientists with his fists. With blood seeping from under their gas masks, 2 of the scientists crawled on all 4s toward the low door of the cage, but the giant caught them by their ankles and hauled them back, and climbing over their bodies, pounded their faces into the cement floor. In the other cages, the prisoners called to the giant scavenger to free them, but he kept lifting the heads by the hair and smashing them into the cement. It was Almaghul's voice that finally penetrated to the wild man's brain. Gasping for air, a maniacal gleam in his bulging eyes, the scavenger released his grip on the bloody heads and looked up. Almaghul called his name and spoke soothingly to him in the strange language of the scavengers. The giant, his arms and shirt drenched in blood, crawled through the door of his cage and staggered to his feet. The other prisoners were all talking to him at once. Almaghul spoke quietly to the giant. Martin noticed that mucus was seeping from his nostrils as he lurched across the basement to the stainless steel table, snapped off one of the legs, and came back to the cages. One by one, he slipped the narrow end of the steel leg through the padlocks and, using the bars for leverage, snapped open the locks. Martin was the last to emerge from the cages. The giant collapsed at his feet. Martin, reaching to help him, found he was burning with fever.
"There is nothing we can do for him," Almaghul said.
The other scavengers backed away from the fallen man until Almaghul snapped angrily at them. One of them came forward and brought the stainless steel table leg down on the giant's head to put him out of his misery. Then, armed with steel legs from the table and the wooden legs broken off chairs, the scavengers made their way up the stone steps. Almaghul, leading the way, carefully opened the steel door leading to the bio-warfare laboratory and stepped aside to let the others through. 2 Russian scientists napping on cots were strangled to death by the desperate prisoners. 3 other scientists were working with frozen anthrax spores in a walk-in refrigerator. Martin thrust one of the stainless steel legs through the door handles, locking the Russians inside, and then turned up the thermostat. The three scientists, realizing they were trapped, began pounding on the thick glass window in the door. One of the prisoners found a plastic jerry can in a closet filled with kerosene for the heating unit. He splashed kerosene over the shelves filled with petri dishes and filing cabinets. Almaghul struck a match and tossed it into the spilled kerosene. A bluish fire skidded across the floor. In a moment, the laboratory was awash in flames. The escaping scavengers stumbled across two guards playing backgammon in an antechamber with razor-stropped, one-edged Cossack sabers stacked in four old umbrella stands. Both of the guards lunged for their rifles but were clubbed to death before they could reach them. Snatching the two rifles, stuffing their pockets with bullets, Martin and Almaghul led the scavengers, armed now with sabers, up a back staircase that led to the lobby. The single guard on duty there backed against a wall and raised his hands in surrender when he saw the scavengers. One of them walked up to him and split his skull open with a single stroke of his sword. On a gesture from Martin, the men spread out and burst through the several double doors into the auditorium. The fight was short and lethal. Furiously working the bolt of his rifle, hardly bothering to take aim, Martin, a pulse pounding in his temple, his trigger finger trembling, provided covering fire from the back of the auditorium as the escaping prisoners, brandishing the sabers over their heads and screaming savagely, charged down the aisles. The warlord, who had been holding court from the throne, cowered behind it as his guards, caught by surprise, desperately tried to fight off the attackers. Two of the prisoners were killed before they reached the stage. A third was shot in the face as he climbed onto it. When Martin's bolt-action rifle jammed, he caught Lincoln's voice roaring in his ear, "Grab it by the barrel, for Christ's sake! Use it as a club!" Grabbing the hot barrel with both hands, Martin joined the battle on the stage, clubbing wildly at the guards as they tried to fend off the blows with their rifles or their arms. When one of the guards stumbled, Martin pounced on him and pinned him down while a prisoner hacked off the guard's hand holding the rifle. Breathing heavily, Martin stood up as another prisoner planted one foot on the ass of the fallen man and slid open his back, exposing his spine from the neck down to the coccyx. Gradually, the prisoners, pushed by a ferocity that came from having nothing to lose and their lives to win, overpowered the guards who were still alive. The wounded guards, with blood gushing from ugly gashes, and the three who surrendered were hauled into the orchestra pit and decapitated with saber strokes to the napes of their necks. One headless man took several short steps before collapsing to the floor. Martin, sick to his stomach, watched the scavengers circle around the throne almost as if they were playing a harmless child's game. Hamlet had pulled the square of thick theater curtain that had been laid down as a carpet over his head. The scavengers tore it away from his clutching hands and prodded the warlord to his feet with the points of their sabers. Wiping snot from his nose, Hamlet begged for mercy as the prisoners stripped away his canvas leggings and boots and gloves and goggles and marched him through the auditorium and lobby and out into the street. Picking his way barefoot through the gutter to avoid the fleas, Hamlet kept babbling in the strange language of the scavengers, but nobody paid the slightest attention to what he was saying. As the sun edged above the horizon, the group retraced the route Martin had taken into Cantubec, passing the ornate building with the mosaic in the lobby depicting the weight of the state. When they reached the motor pool hangar, a swirl in sand and dust, the scavengers found a roll of electric wire and lashed the warlord of Vorozhdnia Island to one of the gutted green trucks, his wrists bound over his head to the rusted frame of a window, his bare feet just reaching the drift of sand when he stood on his toes. The warlord whimpered something, and Almaghul, watching from the street, called out a translation for Martin.
"He pleads with them not to leave him where the rodents and fleas can get to him. He appeals to be shot."
"Ask him where Samat went when he left here," Martin shouted.
"I do not understand his answer," Almaghul called back. "He says something about the bones of a saint being returned to a church in Lithuania."
"Ask him if the church is in the village of Zuzovka, near the frontier with Belarus."
"I think he has become mad. He tells only that Samat is a saint. He says this over and over."
Hamlet Akba could be heard ranting incoherently as the four surviving prisoners and Martin and Almaghul made their way along the track that ran through the dunes to the beached boat. At one point, Martin stopped to look back at Hamlet. He was about to start up the dunes toward the warlord when he heard Dante's wild Irish cackle in his ear.
"Don't you know the Bible instructs victims how to survive emotionally? An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a burning for a burning, laddie."
When Martin hesitated, Dante sighed in despair. "Aye, you're a weak-kneed excuse for a man." Martin had to agree. Nodding grimly, he turned and stumbled down the hill to join the others on the beach. The men rinsed the blood off their bodies in the sea and tugged the boat off the sand and climbed aboard. Al-Nagul started the outboard, sending the white flamingos scattering into the air. She backed the boat until the water was deep enough to swing it around and head at full throttle toward the mainland. While Al-Nagul distributed watermelon and goat cheese from the hamper, Martin gazed back at the ghost town of Kantubek, growing smaller and smaller until it finally vanished into the tulle-like haze that thickened as the sun stepped higher in the east. The solemn time server behind the counter at the central post office in Nukus had never before placed a call out of the country and needed to read the appropriate chapter in a manual before she could figure out the various codes and how to charge for the communication. On the third attempt, she finally got through to a place she had never heard of, the borough of Brooklyn, and punched the chess timer that she used to measure the duration of calls. "Stella, is that you?" Martin called into the phone in the open booth, while the half-dozen people queuing for pension checks looked on in wonderment at someone dispatching his voice across Europe and the Atlantic Ocean to the United States of America and receiving an answer within a fraction of a second. "Did you catch up with Samat?" "I missed him, but it couldn't have been by much. The basketball court was blackened by exhaust."
"You okay, Martin?"
"I am now. It was touch and go for a while."
"What does a basketball court have to do with Samat?"
"It had a white circle painted on it, which means it had been turned into a helicopter pad. Unlike me, Samat travels first class. I come chugging after him in open boats with outboard motors. How are you making out with your new front tooth?"
"I decided you were right about the old chipped tooth. It had a certain charm, even if it did make me look breakable. I don't recognize the person looking back at me in the mirror."
"You can always chip the new tooth."
"Very funny. Martin, don't get angry, but you are tracking down Samat, aren't you?"
"What kind of a question is that?"
"I've been doing a lot of thinking lately. The fact is, I hardly know you. I don't think you're a serial killer or anything like that, but you could be a serial liar. You could be phoning me from Hoboken and making the rest up."
"I'm phoning you from a post office in Uzbekistan. The woman who put the call through had never called out of the country before."
"I want to believe you. I really do. But the people you used to work for, you know whom I mean, sent a lady psychiatrist around yesterday. Her name was Bernice Treffler. She said she'd treated you after you were laid off."
"What else did she say?"
"She said, oh, Martin."
"Spit it out."
"She said you were off your rocker. Are you? Off your rocker, Martin?"
"Yes and no." Stella exploded.
"What kind of an answer is that, for God's sake? Either you are or you aren't. There's no middle ground."
"It's more complicated than you think. There is a middle ground. I'm not insane, but there are things I can't remember."
"What kind of things?"
The time server, watching the chess clock, muttered something to Al-Magul, who came over to tug at Martin's sleeve.
"She says this is going to cost you the wages of a year."
Martin waved the girl away. "Somewhere along the way," he told Stella, "I lost track of which of the several skins I lived in was the real me." He could hear Stella groan into the phone.
"Oh, God, I should have known it was too good to be true."
"Stella, listen. What I have wrong with me isn't fatal, either for me or for us."
"Us?"
"Us is what we're both worried about, isn't it?"
"Wow. I admit there are moments when you sound as if you could be off your rocker. Then there are other moments when you sound perfectly sane to me."
"I am imperfectly sane." Stella started laughing.
"I can live with imperfection."
Suddenly the line went dead in Martin's ear. "Stella? Stella, are you still there?" He called to Al-Magul. "Tell her the line's been cut." When Al-Magul translated, the time server reached out and punched the chess clock with her fist and began calculating the cost of the call on an abacus. When she had figured out the sum, she wrote it on a scrap of paper and held it up so everyone in the post office could tell their children about the deranged foreigner who had spent a fortune to dispatch his voice to a place on the far side of the Atlantic Ocean with the unlikely name of Brooklyn. 1997. Martin Odom reaches no woman's land. Martin Odom pulled the Lada he'd rented in Hrodna, the last big burg in Belarus before the Lithuanian border, Off the two-lane highway that had been repaved so many times, each layer piled on top of the previous one, it probably ranked, rising above the wetlands as it did, as an elevated highway. He killed the motor and strolled over to a mossy embankment above the Niemen River and urinated against a scorched oak that looked as if it had been struck by lightning. Martin had crossed the frontier at a dusty village, half of it in Belarus, the other half in Lithuania, with a tongue-twister of a name. The young border guards, sunning themselves in deck chairs beside a low prefabricated building on the village's dusty main street, had waved him past without so much as a glance at the Canadian passport made out in the name of one Josef Kafkor. At regular intervals, the route had been blocked by sheep, and he'd had to honk his way through them. The last signpost he'd seen before he stopped to relieve his bladder had put his destination, the river town of Zizovka, at 18 kilometers. Keeping track of the distance on the odometer, Martin reckoned it would be around the next bend in the Niemen. Overhead, a high-flying jetliner, its two white contrails drifting apart and thickening behind it, vanished into a fleecy mare's tail of a cloud. Moments later, the distant drone of the motors reached Martin's ears, leaving him with the impression that the noise was racing to catch up with the engines producing it. How he ached to be on that plane, gazing down at the Baltic flatlands as he headed toward home, toward Stella. How he ached to stop looking over his shoulder every time he stepped into a street, to put the quest for Samat behind him and go back to boring himself to death, a pastime his sometime Chinese girlfriend Min had once described as suicide in slow motion. Once he'd crossed the border into Lithuania, Martin noticed that the elevated highway had gradually filled with traffic heading in the direction of Zizovka. There were open farm trucks and dilapidated school buses crammed with peasants, and scores of men in loose shirts and baggy trousers trudging along on foot. Curiously, all of them carried pitchforks, or what Dante Pippin would have called shillelaghs, sturdy cudgels with knobs on one end, fashioned from the thick branches of oaks. As Martin started back to his car now, two shaggy horses that looked as if they might have been on their way to the abattoir clopped past, hauling a wooden cart loaded with bricks. The old peasant, perched high up in the driver's seat, gripped the reins casually in one hand and with the other touched two fingers to the visor of his cap in salute when Martin called out a greeting in broken Russian. The old man clicked his tongue at the horses, which didn't need much coaxing to pull up. Martin waved to the knots of men filling the road on their way towards Zizovka and raised his hands, as if to ask, "Where is everyone going?" The old man leaned over and spit eucalyptus juice onto the highway. Then, scrutinizing the foreigner through eyes with a suggestion of Mongolia in them, he allowed us how St. Gediman has come back to Zizovka. "Gediman died 600 years ago, Martin remarked to himself. The peasant, speaking slowly and articulating carefully as if he were instructing a child, said, "Gediman's bones, which the German invaders stole from our church, have by miracle been returned." From some remote corner of his brain, Martin assembled Russian words into a sentence. "And how did the bones of the saint find their way back to Zizovka?" A cagey grin appeared on the old man's weathered face. "How else would a saint travel except by private helicopter?" "And how long ago did the helicopter bringing the bones of the saint arrive in Zizovka?" The peasant pointed his chin at the sky and shut his eyes as he ticked off the days on the fingers of a hand. "One day before today, the widow Potiesta's cow drowned in the Niemen. 2 days before today, Idintas wound the cord attached to his bull around the palm of his right hand, and then lost all of his fingers except for the thumb when the bull charged laundry hanging on a line. 3 days before today, the wife of the drunken shepherd walked all the way to Zizovka's pharmacy to treat a broken nose, though she refused to identify the owner of the fist that had broken it." Looking down at Martin, the peasant grinned. 3 days before today, the helicopter brought the bones of the saint to Zizovka." "And why are all the men heading toward town armed?" "To join the Metropolitan Alphonsus and defend Gediman from the Romish." The old man laughed at Martin's ignorance as he clucked at the horses and snapped at them with the reins. Martin slipped behind the wheel of the Lada, started the motor, and honked twice at the peasant as he pulled into the left lane and passed him. The old man, still laughing, again touched the visor of his cap with two fingers in salute, though this time there was more derision than politeness in the gesture. Zizovka, a sprawling market town with a tractor repair station next to the brightly painted wooden arch that marked the beginning of its long and wide and dusty main street, materialized around the next bend. The town's two-story brick school sat on a patch of sandy land across from the tractor station. The school's soccer pitch, like the basketball court on Vozrozhdinye Island in the Aral Sea, had been converted into a helicopter landing pad, with a great circle of whitewashed stones set out in the middle of the field, blackened by engine exhaust. Martin had to slow to a crawl behind the line of open trucks and men afoot, all heading in the direction of the Orthodox Church, situated on a dirt lane that angled off from the main street and ran across the wetlands to the muddy bank of the Niemen. Parking his car in front of a bakery with a sign on the door announcing that due to Catholic threats to liberate St. Gedimen, it would not be open for business today, Martin melted into the throngs. He grabbed a teenage boy by the arm.
"Gdzie?"
he asked. "Where are the women?"
"Zuzovka is a no-woman's land,"
the boy, grinning from ear to ear, shot back as he hurried after the others. The peasants, joking among themselves about the Catholic skulls they would split open and the Catholic blood that would irrigate Orthodox soil, barely noticed the stranger among them. Dozens of rowboats were tied up at the rickety wooden docks along the riverbank, and groups of armed men could be seen climbing the slope toward the church. A fire brigade band, the men dressed in knee-high boots and red parkas, was trumpeting martial airs from the iron gazebo in a fenced park across the lane. Drawing nearer to the church, Martin produced the laminated card that identified him as a wire service reporter and, brandishing it over his head, called out that he was a Canadian journalist. The crowd parted when several of the local notables, distinguishable from the farmers because they wore double-breasted suit jackets with their shirts buttoned up to the neck, instructed the peasants to let the foreign journalist through. Hobbling along on his game leg, which had been acting up since he quit the Aral area, Martin shouldered through the several hundred ripe-smelling peasants toward the three onion domes, each topped with a rusted Orthodox cross. Two young Orthodox priests, dressed in sandals and black habits, waved him up the steps and into the church and bolted its metal-studded wooden door behind him with a thick wooden crossbar thrust through iron staples and then embedded in niches chiseled into the stones on either side. The church reeked of incense and the smoke of beeswax candles and the dust and dankness of centuries, and it took a moment for Martin's eyes to make anything out in the misty dimness. The silver and gold in the icons on the sweating walls glinted as a tall bearded man dressed in a black habit, with chiseled features and a squared black mitre atop his long black hair, approached. With each step, he pounded the floor with the silver tip of a thick staff.
"Do you speak Canadian?"
the priest demanded in English, planting himself in front of the visitor. Martin nodded.
"I am the Metropolitan Alphonsus,"
the priest thundered.
"Come from the district capital of Alitos to receive the bones of St. Gedimen and defend the Church of the Transfiguration from the papists who connive to steal the holy relics from their rightful owners."
"Uh-huh." Before he could say more, floodlight blinded Martin. Squinting, he made out the figure of a television cameraman advancing across the floor of the church. The light fixed to the heavy camera on his shoulder bored into the feretory set in a wall to one side of the pulpit. One of the young priests undid a padlock and swung open a thick glass door as the cameraman zoomed in on the velvet cushion with what looked like a bleached pelvis bone and femur nestled in it. Martin noticed a splinter of weathered wood, roughly the thickness and length of a forearm, set into a niche lined with gold cloth inside the feretory.
"And what is that morsel of wood?" he whispered to the Metropolitan.
Alphonse's eyes turned hollow with wrath.
"That is not wood!" he cried. "It is a fragment of the true cross!"
Overcome with emotion, the Metropolitan turned away and, murmuring verses in Russian, prostrated himself on the great stones of the floor, under which corpses of Metropolitans and monks were interred. Guided by a producer, the cameraman panned with his floodlight and lens onto Elitus and held it there while a very chic young woman spoke into a microphone in what Martin took to be BBC Lithuanian. She broke off the interview abruptly when a roar from outside the church penetrated the thick walls. One of the priests, scampering up a ladder and peering through a slit high in a bartizan, called out,
"Holy Father, the battle has begun!"
The Metropolitan sprang to his feet and motioned for the glass door of the feretory to be shut and locked. Gripping his staff by the silver tip and resting the heavy jewel-encrusted handle on a shoulder, he planted himself in front of the holy relics of St. Gedimen.
"Over my dead body!"
he cried. He fixed Martin with his dark, beady eyes. "Bear witness," he instructed him,
"to the perversity of the papists who falsely claimed the relics of our saint."
The cameraman cut the floodlight, and the television reporters darted toward the narrow door in the back of the church. The Metropolitan cried out when he saw them tugging free the crossbar. Too late. The door burst open on its hinges, and a mob of shrieking peasants stormed into the church. Flailing away with his heavy staff, the Metropolitan defended the feretory until someone stabbed his thigh with the prongs of a pitchfork, and the peasants wrestled his staff away. Martin backed up against a wall and raised his hands over his head, but some deranged peasants with wild beards and wild eyes closed in on him and began punching him in the ribcage until he doubled over and sank onto the floor. Through the sea of peasants milling around, he could make out one of them raising a heavy candlestick and shattering the glass window of the feretory. The pillow with the bones of the saint was removed, and the peasant army, throwing open the great front door, spilled out of the church. A howl of triumph rose from the throats of the Catholics outside. Faint from the pain in his chest, Martin saw the Metropolitan on his knees in front of the feretory, sobbing like a baby. Lithuanian police and an army unit, pouring into Zizovka from the north aboard camouflage-painted armored buses, eventually succeeded in separating the warring communities, but not before two of the attacking Catholics and one of the young Orthodox priests had been clubbed to death and dozens on both sides injured. Their sirens jingling, ambulances arrived behind the police. Doctors and nurses scrambled across the battleground in front of the Orthodox church, treating broken bones and broken heads and hauling the more seriously hurt off on stretchers to the district hospital in Alytus. Martin's ribcage was taped up by a male nurse, after which he was escorted by armed soldiers to the command post, set up in the gazebo, to be quizzed by an army colonel with waxed whiskers, who seemed more interested in the impression he would make on television than the confrontation between the town's Orthodox and Catholic communities. Looking appropriately grave, he finished giving an interview to the woman reporter from Vilnius and asked her when it would be broadcast, and then instructed an aide to phone his wife in Kaunas to make sure she caught him on TV. With the television crew off filming the wounded in the field, the officer turned to Martin and checked his identity papers. To be sure that the story the journalist named Kafkor filed, to the news service named on the laminated ID card, would take into consideration the Catholic side of the story, like the vast majority of Lithuanians, the colonel was Catholic, he insisted on personally taking Martin in his jeep to talk with the bishop of the archdiocese, come all the way from Vilnius to support the local Catholic priests and members of the diocese. The bishop turned out to be a cheery little man with wide hips and narrow shoulders, giving him the appearance, in his crimson ankle-length robe and embroidered stole, of a church bell. The meeting took place in the vegetable garden behind the church. Two white storks peered down at the scene from the large nest on top of the bell tower.
"Dates," the bishop said, leaning into a lecture he had obviously given before, "are handy pegs on which to hang history. Do you not agree with this observation, Mr. Kafkor?"
Martin, wincing from the pain in his ribs, used the tips of the white silk scarf tied around his neck to blot the perspiration on his forehead. "Uh-huh." The army officer thrust a pad and ballpoint pen into Martin's hands.
"You must take notes," he whispered.
As Martin scribbled, the bishop paced between the furrows, the hem of his robe growing dirtier with each step, as he explained the history of St. Gediminas.
"It was Gediminas, as every schoolchild in Lithuania knows, who created Greater Lithuania, a vast duchy that stretched from the Black Sea to Moscow to the Baltic. He ruled over the empire from the capital he founded in Vilnius in the year of our Lord Jesus, 1321. 65 years later, in the year of our Lord, 1386, Lithuanians, by the grace of God, adopted Catholicism as the state religion, and on the order of the Grand Duke, the entire population was baptized on the banks of the Niemen, at which time it can be said that the last Lithuanian pagans vanished into the dustbin of history."
"Did you get all that?" the army officer demanded.
"The first Catholic church," the bishop plunged breathlessly on, "was built on this very site 10 years after the mass baptism, and expended,"
he pointed to the bell tower and the Jesse window and the two vaulted wings,
"in the centuries that followed. The bones of St. Gediminas, or what was left of him after the original crypt in Vilnius was desecrated by Tartar bandits, were consigned to the Catholic Church at Zizovka, and remained there from early in the 14th century until Lithuania came under Russian domination in 1795. The Russians, being Eastern Orthodox, purloined the bones of the saint from the Catholic Church and gave them to the Orthodox Metropolitan, who had the Church of the Transfiguration built to house them. Despite our repeated petitions over the years, The bones remained in the possession of the Orthodox until a German army officer, retreating before a Russian offensive in 1944, stole the relics as he passed through Zuzovka.
Hoping to cut short the story, Martin said, it was Samatul Gorzhilov who discovered the Orthodox Church possessed a collection of priceless Torah scrolls and commentaries, and offered to trade the bones of St. Gedeman, which he had traced to an Orthodox church in Argentina, for the Jewish documents. The bishop danced a jig at the mention of Samat's name.
But that is not it at all! That's the fabricated story that this satanic Samat Ugorzhilov and the Metropolitan would have the world believe. The truth is quite different.
Mark the truth in your notebook, the army officer instructed Martin.
The bishop noticed the dirt that had accumulated on the hem of his robe and reached down to brush it off.
The television tells us that Samat Ugorzhilov, who is identified as a Russian philanthropist, returned the bones of St. Gedeman in exchange for the Jewish Torah scrolls and commentaries held for safekeeping in the Orthodox Church since the Great Patriotic War. The television goes on to say that all he asked for himself was a minuscule crucifix, fashioned from the wood of the so-called True Cross in the possession of the Orthodox Church. The TV even showed a picture of the Metropolitan handing to the so-called philanthropist the crucifix, which was the size of a pinky finger on a child. Samat thanked the Metropolitan and said he would donate the crucifix, fashioned from the True Cross, to the Orthodox Church in the village near Moscow where his mother still lived.
Martin looked up from his note-taking, his eyes burning with excitement. Did he give the name of this village? The bishop shook his heavy head. His jowls continued to roll from side to side after his head had returned to an even keel.
No. What does it matter?
Without waiting for a response, he continued.
The real reason this Samat Ugorzhilov gave the saint's bones to the Orthodox and not to its original Catholic custodians is opium.
Martin, unnerved, looked up again. Opium?
Opium, the army officer repeated, tapping a forefinger on Martin's pad. Write the word, if you please.
Opium, the bishop said, is the key to understanding what has transpired. The opium poppy is grown in what is called the Golden Triangle, Burma, Thailand, Laos. Vietnamese drug traders transport the raw opium to the Russian naval base at Cam Ranh Bay in Vietnam. And from there it is shipped to the Russian port of Nakhodka on the Sea of Japan. The Russian drug cartel, which was run by the one known as the oligarch, Tsvetan Ugorzhilov, until he went into hiding several years ago, processes the opium in Nakhodka and then smuggles it across Russia for distribution to markets in Europe and America. Since the late 1980s, Zuzovka has served as a hub for shipping opium to northern Europe and Scandinavia. Landing strips were bulldozed onto the flatlands bordering the Niemen, and small planes flying at night ferried their illicit cargoes into this corner of Lithuania. To move the large quantities of opium westward, Samat Ugorzhilov employed runners disguised as Orthodox priests, since they are able to pass frontiers easily. When the Metropolitan threatened to put a stop to this, Samat bought him off by tracking down and returning Gedeman's bones.
The bishop's eyes blinked mischievously,
assuming that what he brought to the church were really the bones of the sainted saint.
What about the Torah scrolls?
The Metropolitan did not want to be seen having commercial dealings with sacred texts, so he consigned them to Samat, who sold them to an Israeli museum and donated the proceeds, less a hefty commission, to the Orthodox Church.
And how did you come across all this information? The bishop glanced up at the storks in the nest atop the bell tower.
A very large bird told me.
Martin closed his pad and dropped it into a pocket.
It seems as if every riddle is part of another greater riddle. It is like an onion,
the bishop said consolingly.
Under each layer is another layer.
One last question. If you're not sure the bones Samat brought with him are those of the sainted saint, why were the Catholics battling to bring them back to the Catholic Church? The bishop held up one of his small, pristine hands as if he were directing traffic.
Whether the bones of the sainted saint are genuine is of little consequence. The only thing that matters is that the faithful believe they are.
That night, the colonel personally drove Martin back to his Lada, still parked in front of the bakery.
How are your ribs, Mr. Kafkor?
They only hurts when I laugh, and there's not much chance I'll be laughing a lot.
Well, goodbye and godspeed, Mr. Kafkor. I have ordered the soldiers in the jeep to escort you to the Belarus frontier.
When Martin started to protest that it wouldn't be necessary, the colonel cut him off.
Our police discovered two bloated bodies floating in the Niemen this afternoon. At first, they assumed the murdered men were Catholics killed by the Orthodox, or Orthodox killed by Catholics. A specialist from Vilnius identified the long knife found in one of the corpses as a weapon popular in Chechnya, which suggests that the two dead men were Chechens.
Maybe they were involved in Samat's opium cartel, Martin ventured. The colonel shrugged.
There may be a connection between the dead Chechens and Samat, though I doubt it had anything to do with the opium operation. Islam is not welcomed in this frontier region of Lithuania, either by the Catholics or the Orthodox. No, the only thing that could have brought Chechens here is a mission. Though, with them being drowned, it is impossible to speculate what it could have been. You would not have an idea?
Martin shook his head. It's as much a mystery to me as it is to you.
The following morning, Martin treated himself to a good breakfast in Hrodna's only hotel, and then strolled carefully, his cracked ribs hurt if he walked too fast, along the main street, past the bulletin board posted with the regional newspaper open to photographs of the riot at Zuzovka, to the town's central post office. He queued at the window with the emblem of a telephone over it, and wrote the number on the ledger when the clerk didn't understand his rudimentary Russian.
"What country uses code 972?"
she asked.
"Israel."
"And what city in Israel uses the area code 2?
"Jerusalem."
The clerk noted Jerusalem, Israel, on her worksheet, and dialed the number. She motioned for Martin to pick up the telephone in the nearest booth. He heard a man's voice on the line, protesting.
"This must be a mistake. I don't know anyone in Belarus." "Benny, it's me, Martin."
"What the Christ are you doing in Belarus?"
"It's a long story."
"Give me the short version."
"Even the short version's too long to tell you on the phone. Listen, Benny, that night I spent at your house, you told me about the oligarch living in an isolated dacha in a village a half hour from Moscow along the Moscow-Petersburg highway. You wouldn't by any chance remember the name of the village."
"You want to hold on. I'll check my computer."
Martin watched the people lining up at the other windows, some for stamps, some to pay electric or water bills, some to cash pension checks. None of them looked out of place, which didn't mean much. Anyone who wanted to keep tabs on him would use local help. Benny came back on the line.
"The name of the village is Prigorodnaya."
"Maybe you ought to spell that."
Benny did, phonetically.
"Prigorodnaya."
"Thanks, Benny."
"I guess you're welcome, though come to think of it, I'm not positive."
1994. Lincoln Dittman sets the record straight. Bernice Treffler knew something was out of joint the moment Martin Odom strolled into the room. A grin meant to be both sardonic and seductive played on his lips, as if a session with a company shrink came under the heading of indoor sport and she was fair game. He appeared taller, more assured, less agitated, completely in control of emotions that he could identify. His body language was new to her. His head was angled suggestively, his shoulders relaxed, one hand jingled the loose change in a trouser pocket. He walked with only the faintest trace of a limp. She could have sworn that his hair was combed differently, though she would have had to pull a photograph of Martin from the file folder to be positive, which is something she didn't want to do in front of him. Instead of sitting across the desk from her, as he usually did, he flopped gracefully into a chair next to the low table near the window, his legs extended and crossed casually at the ankles, and nodded at another chair, inviting her to join him, sure she would. When she did, she noticed him undressing her with his eyes as she came across the carpet. She saw him inspecting her thigh when she crossed her legs. She set the small tape recorder down and edged the microphone closer to Martin. He fixed his gaze on her eyes, and she found herself toying with the joint on the fourth finger of her left hand, where the gold ring used to be before the divorce.
"You're wearing perfume," he noted. "What is it?"
When she didn't respond, he tried another tack.
"Is Treffler your married name?"
"No, I work under my maiden name."
"You don't wear a wedding band, but I could tell you're married."
Her gaze fell away from his.
"What gave me away?"
"You're sure you want to know?" he asked, clearly taunting her.
Why was Martin Odom coming on to her, she wondered. What had changed since the session the previous month?
Leaning forward, aware that in this new incarnation he wouldn't miss the slight swell of her breasts above the scalloped blouse, she flipped a switch on the tape recorder. "Mind if I check your voice level again?"
"Be my guest."
He clasped his hands behind his head and leaned back into them, thoroughly enjoying how uncomfortable he had managed to make her.
"A woman, a dog, a walnut tree," he recited, pronouncing dog, dog. "The more you beat 'em, the better they be."
"That another line from Walter Whitman? He laughed softly. "It's a ditty the boys used to sing around the campfire while they were waiting to cross the Rappahannock." Suddenly it hit her.
"You're not Martin Odom."
"And you're not as thick as Martin says."
"You're the one who claims to have been at the Battle of Fredericksburg," she breathed. "You're Lincoln Ditman."
He only smiled.
"But why? What are you doing here?"
"Martin told you about my being at Fredericksburg, but you didn't believe him. You thought he was making the whole thing up." Lincoln leaned forward, the humor gone from his eyes.
"You went and hurt his feelings, Dr. Treffler. Shrinks are supposed to heal feelings, not hurt them. Martin sent me round to set the record straight."
Dr. Treffler understood that she was setting out into uncharted territory.
"Okay, convince me Lincoln Ditman was at the Battle of Fredericksburg. What else did the boys talk about while they were waiting to cross the river?"
Lincoln stared out the window, his eyes wide, unblinking, unfocused.
"They talked about home remedies for diarrhea, which many considered the archenemy more dangerous than Johnny Reb. They traded recipes for moonshine. I recall one lieutenant from the 70th Ohio concocted something he labeled Knock 'em Stiff. It consisted of bark juice, tar water, turpentine, brown sugar, lamp oil, and alcohol. They argued whether, when they crossed the river and marched on Richmond and won the war, the slaves ought to be freed. So many were against that the few who were for were careful to keep their own counsel. They griped about having to pay $1.80 for a plug of tobacco. They griped about the Yankees who'd gone west to avoid the draft and claim free land while they were stuck on the Rappahannock fighting the goddamn war. They griped about the factory-made shoddy.
Shoddy?
What we called shoddy was woolen yarn made from old clothing and then turned into material for uniforms that disintegrated under your fingers in a matter of weeks.
What was your rank?
Lincoln turned back to focus on Dr. Treffler.
I wasn't in the army.
If you weren't in the army, what were you doing at Fredericksburg?
Fact is, I'd been working for Alan Pinkerton in Chicago. You ever heard of Pinkerton's detective agency?
When Dr. Treffler nodded, he said, thought you might have.
Alan was employed by his friend Colonel McClellan to eliminate banditry from the railroads out west. When Old Abe appointed the colonel to head the Army of the Potomac, McClellan brought along his friend Alan Pinkerton, who was using the pseudonym E.J. Allen at the time, if I remember right. And Alan brought along some of his operatives, me among them, to organize an intelligence service. Then came what the Federals called the Battle of Antietam after the stream, and the Confederates called the Battle of Sharpsville after the village. With the help of General Joe Hooker, who tore himself away from his camp followers, what we jokingly called Hooker's girls or just plain Hookers, long enough to lead the attack on the right, McClellan won the day and Bobby Lee was obliged to pull his force, what was left of it, back into Virginia. Antietam was the first time I saw the elephant.
Saw the elephant?
That's how we described experiencing combat. You say you saw the elephant. After the battle, Allen sent several of us riding south to discern the Confederate order of battle, but that old snake in the grass Lee bamboozled us. He must have figured we could estimate his troop strength by counting the rations he issued, 'cause he doubled the rations and we doubled the size of his army, and McClellan got cold feet and stayed put, which is when Old Abe decided that McClellan had got the slows and sent him packing back to Chicago. Alan Pinkerton went along with him, but I stayed on to work for Lafayette Baker, who was setting up a federal intelligence service in Washington. Which brings me to McClellan's successor, Ambrose Burnside, and Fredericksburg.
Leaning forward, Lincoln picked up the small microphone and spoke into it. A woman, a dog, a walnut tree, the more you beat 'em, the better they be. Hey, Doc, what about you and me having dinner together when we're finished here?
Bernice Treffler kept her face a blank and her voice neutral.
You'll understand that this is simply not possible. A psychiatrist cannot have a relationship with a client outside of working hours and still hope to maintain the distance she needs to evaluate the client.
Where is it written there has to be a distance between you and the client? Some psychiatrists sleep with their patients in order to bridge this distance.
That's not the way I function, Lincoln.
She tried to make a joke out of it.
Maybe you need another psychiatrist.
You'll do fine.
Why don't you go on with your story?
My story? You think it's a story?
He set the microphone back on the table.
You still don't see what I'm telling you really happened. To me, at Fredericksburg.
Lincoln Ditman taught history at a junior college, Dr. Treffler said patiently. He turned his college thesis on the Battle of Fredericksburg into a book and printed it himself under the title Cannon Fodder when he couldn't find an editor willing to publish the manuscript.
There are things that happened at Fredericksburg you can't find in any history book, or cannon fodder, for that matter.
Such as?
Lincoln was angry now.
All right. Burnside force-marched the Union Army down the Rappahannock, but wound up bivouacking across the river from Fredericksburg for 10 long days, waiting for the damn pontoon bridges to catch up with him. Lafayette Bakard posted me to Burnside's staff. I was supposed to figure out the Confederate order of battle so Burnside could reckon on what was waiting for him once he got across the river. Armed with an English spyglass, I spent the better part of the first 9 days aloft, freezing my ass off in a hot air balloon. But the mustard-thick haze hanging over the river never burned off, and I couldn't make heads or tails of what was going on up on the ridgeline behind Fredericksburg. Which is why I decided to infiltrate the Confederate lines. I found a sunken fisherman's dinghy and raised it with the help of some skirmishers, and greased the oarlocks and set off before sunrise to cross the river, which was in flood, creating a margin of shallow marshes on either side. When my dinghy couldn't make it as far as the shore, I pulled off my boots and socks and rolled up my trousers and climbed out and waded through the slime until I reached solid ground. I found myself on the slope below the lunatic asylum. The doctors and nurses had fled inland when Burnside's army appeared on the other side of the river, leaving the demented women to fend for themselves. They were leaning out of windows, some of them clothed, some buff naked, mesmerized by the sight of the Federal soldiers urinating into the river, also by the occasional mortar shot Yankee gunners lobbed across the Rappahannock and the ensuing explosions on the heights behind Fredericksburg. The demented women were sure something dreadful was about to happen. Sure, too, that they were meant to witness it and spread the story. So one young lady with tufts of matted hair hanging over her bare breasts screeched to me from a window when I made my way up the hill past the asylum. The memory of the poor lunatics trapped between the lines in their asylum set Lincoln to breathing hard through his nostrils. Dr. Treffler said very quietly, "Want to take a break, Lincoln?" He shook his head roughly. I purloined an orderly's smock from the laundry shed behind the asylum and put it on and walked through Fredericksburg in the direction of Mary's Hill. The city was deserted except for sentinels who, seeing the white smock, took me for someone employed at the asylum. I made a mental note of everything I saw. Fredericksburg itself was obviously not going to be defended, despite the occasional Mississippi sharpshooter firing across the river from buildings along the waterfront. I made my way out of the city, past buildings with greased paper serving as windows, past an emporium with boards nailed over the doors and windows, as if this would stop looters, and headed across the plain. I could see that no effort had been made to dig trenches or pits, and I began to wonder if there was to be a battle after all. Then I came to the sunken road under Mary's Hill, with a stone wall running the length of it, and I knew there would be a battle and that it would go against the Federals. For the sunken road was a crawl with Confederates. There were sharpshooters polishing the brass scopes of their Whitworths and setting out the paper cartridges on top of the stone wall. There were short-muzzled cannon with grape charges piled next to their wheels. There were officers afoot with swords and long-muzzled pistols directing newly arrived troops into the line. There were Confederate flags and unit flags furled and leaning against trees, so the Federals, when they finally appeared, would not know what they were up against until it was too late to turn back. The single unfurled flag visible to the naked eye belonged to the 24th Georgians, known to be hard customers and surpassing marksmen when sober. No way around the sunken road and its stone wall presented itself. To the right it was too swampy for a flanking movement, to the left the road and wall went on forever. I was challenged by pickets several times, but, making laughing reference to the lunatics, I talked my way past and continued up the hill. And back from the crest, out of sight of Pinkerton men peering through spyglasses from balloons, was the largest army I ever set eyes on. There were more cannon than a body could count. Soldiers were watering down the road to suppress the dust as teams of horses positioned the cannon beyond freshly dug earthenworks. A Confederate band belted out waltzes for the Southern gentlemen and ladies who had come down from Richmond to see the battle. My footpath took me past a large gray tent set next to a copse of stunted apple trees, and I saw three generals poring over maps stretched open on a trestle table. One in a white uniform I took for Bobby Lee himself. The second, in homespun gray with plumes fluttering from his hat, I took for George Pickett, which meant that Pickett's division had come up earlier than anticipated and was taking its place in the line. The third, with a woman's woolen shawl draped over his shoulders, I took to be old Pete Longstreet. I was sorely tempted to try for a closer look at the generals and acted upon this desire, which proved to be my undoing. A young officer wearing a brand new uniform with a sash to hold his sword accosted me. My story about being the last orderly to abandon the lunatics to their asylum did not appear to persuade him, and he set me to walking toward the divisional tent on the far side of Mary's Hill, him following close on my heels. As much as I ached to, I could not run for it. All he had to do was raise the alarm, and 1,000 rebels would have been upon me. "Could I trouble you for a glass of water?" "No problem." Dr. Treffler walked over to a sideboard and filled a glass from a plastic bottle and carried it back, aware that Lincoln's eyes never left her. Was he thinking of the young lunatic leaning out the window with the matted hair covering her breasts? Was he regretting he didn't have a shrink who slept with her patients? Lincoln drank off the glass of water in one long swallow and then ran his finger around the rim as he picked up the thread of his tale. "I was closely questioned by a stubby, hunch-shouldered officer with a shock of hair turned silver from age and battle fatigue, so I supposed because he walked with the aid of 2 wooden crutches. And when he didn't esteem my answers, I admitted to having been born and raised in Pennsylvania but claimed I'd gone south to defend states' rights and slavery, for who in his right mind wanted millions of freed slaves invading the North to take away our jobs? He had me stripped to the skin and began examining each item of clothing, which is how he came across the watch fob decorated with the symbol of Alan Pinkerton's detective agency, an unblinking eye that Alan himself had given me back in the days when we were chasing train robbers and cattle thieves. The old officer recognized it immediately, and my efforts to make out that I had got it off one of the crazed women in the asylum fell short of convincing him. "You are a federal spy," he said, "caught behind our lines. Make your peace with your maker, for you will be executed at dawn." Lincoln, reliving the episode, wiped perspiration from his forehead with the back of a wrist. "I was allowed to dress, after which they tied my ankles loosely so I could walk but not run, and took me to a circle of hospital wagons and sat me down at a wooden crate inside one of them to write my last testament and any letters that I deemed necessary to deliver to friends or family. Night fell quickly at this time of the year. The aurora borealis, a rare sight in these latitudes, flickered like soundless cannon fire in the north. It didn't take much imagination to suppose a great war was being fought beyond the horizon. I was brought an oil lamp and a tin plate of hard crackers and water, but try as I might, I was unable to swallow even the spittle in my mouth, the lump in my throat, which I identified as fear, being too big. I attempted to write my mother and father and a girl I'd been sweet on back in Pennsylvania. I wanted to tell them what had befallen me, and so began, 'I take the present opportunity of penning you a few lines. My health is good, but it will not be so for long.' I was obliged to discontinue the letter because my brain, befuddled with chemicals released by fear, could not locate the words to describe my condition. I became convinced that it was all a terrible dream, that any moment I would become too frightened to continue dreaming, that I would force myself through the membrane that separated sleep from wakefulness and wipe the sweat from my brow and, still under the spell of the nightmare, have trouble falling back to sleep. But the wooden crate felt damp and cold under my palm, and a whiff of sulphurous air— In the next wagon, the surgeons, amputating the leg of a boy who had been pinned under an overturned cannon, were dousing the stump with sulfur, stung my lungs, and the pain brought home to me that what had happened and what was about to happen were no dream." Dr. Treffler, caught in the web of Lincoln's tale, leaned toward him when he stopped talking. "Admit it," he said with a sneer. "It's beginning to dawn on you that I'm recounting the truth." When she nodded carefully, he went on. "I was expecting execution by hanging, but the old officer with the silver hair and crutches had something more dreadful in store. At first light, my wrists and elbows were bound behind my back with a length of telegraph wire. I was taken from the hospital wagon by 2 men wearing the striped shirts of the penitentiary guards and paraded to the other side of Mary's Hill and the turnpike known as Plank Road, so called because the craters gouged by several dozen exploding federal mortar rounds had been too deep to fill with earth, and had been covered over with planking to make the road passable. Standing at the lip of one such crater, which was roughly the size of a large wagon wheel, with the planks intended to patch it stacked at the side of the turnpike, it struck me what my interrogator intended when he spoke of execution. One of the penitentiary guards produced a square of straw board with the words "The Spy Ditman" lettered on it in India ink and attached the sign with cotter pins to the back of my shoddy jacket. I divined who the author of my unusual execution was when I caught sight of Stonewall Jackson, known to be a religious fanatic, sitting his horse on a rise above me, a look of unadulterated malevolence on his face. He removed the cigar from his mouth and studied me for a long while, as if he were committing me and the moment to memory. He angrily flicked cigar ashes as he issued instructions to an aide. I was too far away to make out more than a few words. "Buried, that's what I want, but alive." Hundreds of Confederates on the side of the hill had stopped what they were doing to watch the execution. My interrogator plucked a cigarette from the mouth of one of the penitentiary guards and, making his way to me on his crutches, wedged it between my parched lips. "It is a matter of tradition," he said. "A man condemned to death is entitled to a last cigarette." Trembling, I puffed on the cigarette. The act of smoking and the smoke cauterizing my throat distracted me. My interrogator stared at the ash, waiting for it to buckle under its own weight and fall so they could get on with the execution. Sucking on the cigarette, I became aware of the ash, too. Life itself seemed to ride on it. Defying gravity, defying sense, it grew longer than the unsmoked part of the cigarette. And then a whisper of wind coming off the river brought with it the distant sound of a brass band playing Yankee Doodle. Under cover of darkness, the Federals had finally thrown their pontoon bridges across the river and were starting to come over in force. There were scattered shots from Fredericksburg as the Confederate rear guard pretended to put up a fight to suck the Federals into the trap that awaited them once they captured Fredericksburg and started across the plain Richmond bound. The notes of Yankee Doodle and the hollow reports of muskets set everyone to peering toward the river. Bobby Lee reined up next to Jackson, who touched his hat in salute. They talked for a moment, Lee pointing out the Chatham Mansion, which served as Burnside's command post, within eyeshot on the other side of the river. And then Lee happened to glance in my direction. His eyes fixed on me, and he called, "What the blazes is going on down there?" My interrogator called up that I was a Federal spy caught behind the Confederate lines the previous evening, that they were about to bury me alive as a warning to others. Lee remarked something to Jackson, then stood in his stirrups and, removing his white hat, shouted down, "There will be enough killing on these fields today to last a man a lifetime. Tie him to a tree and let him watch the battle and set him free when it is over." Which is how I came to see the elephant again, to witness the carnage that unfolded below Mary's Hill that terrible December day. Burnside's army burst out of Fredericksburg onto the plain and formed up. The 114th Pennsylvania Zouaves, with their white headbands, were the first to charge the stone wall along the sunken road. They came on with pennants flying while a drummer boy set the cadence for the attack until his head was severed from his body by a cannonball. It was a massacre from start to finish. Through the afternoon, wave upon wave of Federals charged the sunken road, only to be cut down by a hail of Minié balls. I counted 14 assaults in all, but not a one of them made it as far as the wall. The cause was so hapless, the Confederates looking down from the hill took to cheering the courage of the Federals. I could see the rebel sharpshooters dipping their hands in buckets of water so they could load their Whitworths, scalding hot from being shot so much, without blistering their skin. At one point in the afternoon, I could make out groups of Federals trying to take cover behind some brick houses on the plain, but the Yankee cavalry, using the flats of sabers, forced them back to the battle. It was a god-awful thing to behold. There have been days since when I wished they'd gone ahead and buried me alive so that the sight and sound of battle would not be graven on my brain. And they let you cross the battlefield to your lines when it was over? As for the field of battle, the less said about it, the better. The temperature that night dipped below freezing, and my breath came out from between my chattering teeth in great white plumes as I negotiated its pitfalls. I ripped the square of straw board off my back and started toward the flames I could see burning in Fredericksburg, tripping over the bloated bodies of horses and men, stumbling onto limbless corpses entangled at the bottom of shell craters. Even in the cold of winter there were horseflies drawn to the blood oozing from wounds. The maimed Federals who were still alive dragged the dead into heaps and burrowed under the corpses to keep warm. To my everlasting regret, I could do nothing for them. I stopped to cradle a dying soldier who had a slip of paper with his name and address pinned to the back of his blouse. He shivered and murmured, "Sarah, dearest," and expired in my arms. I took the paper, meaning to send it to his next of kin, but somehow lost it in the confusion of the night. Riderless horses pawed at the frozen ground looking for fodder, but the only fodder at Fredericksburg on 13 December 1862 was cannon fodder.
You reached the town?
Fredericksburg resembled Sodom. Buildings had been set ablaze by the retreating Federals. The emporium lay gutted, its furniture and wares littering the planks of the sidewalk and the dirt in the street. What was left of silken gowns that had been cut up for handkerchiefs and towels hung limply from placards projecting over the entrances to stores. Mad women from the asylum, in sooty shifts and barefooted, picked through the debris, collecting pocket mirrors and colored ribbons and fine ladies' hats imported from Paris, France, which they pulled over their matted hair. Two of them were struggling to carry off a regulator clock. I was surely one of the last to cross the bridge, because the engineers began to unfasten the pontoons behind me. On the other side, I wandered from campfire to campfire, past dispirited troops dozing on the ground, past pickets sleeping on their feet. I must have become feverish, because much of what happened to me subsequent to the retreat across the pontoon bridge is disjointed and fuzzy in my head. I seem to remember great lines of woe-begone soldiers trudging back toward Washington, the wounded piled three and four deep in open carts drawn by mules, the dead buried in shallow graves where they succumbed. When I came awake, I don't know how many days later, I found myself on a cot stained with dried blood in a field hospital. Doctors decided I was suffering from hypochondria, what your fancy doctors call depression nowadays. A gentleman with a kindly face and a soiled white shirt open at the throat was sponging my chest and neck with vinegar to bring down the fever. We got to talking. He told me his name was Walter. Only later did I discover him to be the celebrated Brooklyn poet Whitman, scouring the field hospitals for his brother George, who'd been listed as wounded in the battle. Luck would have it, he'd found him in the same tent as me. One morning, when I felt stronger, Walter put his arm around my waist and helped me out of the tent into the sunlight. We sat, only the two of us, with our backs to a stack of fresh pine coffins. I remember Walter staring at the heap of amputated limbs behind the tent and opining, "Fredericksburg is the most complete piece of mismanagement perhaps ever yet known in the earth's wars." After some while, orderlies appeared from the tent carrying three stretchers with corpses on them and set them on the ground to attend burial. The dead men were covered with blankets, with the toes of their stockings sticking out and pinned together. Pushing himself to his feet, Walter walked over to the bodies and, squatting, lifted aside the blanket from one and looked for a long, long time at the boy's dead face. When he sat back down next to me, he pulled a notebook from a pocket inside his jacket and, licking the stub of a pencil, began to write in it. When he finished, I asked him what he'd written, and he read it off, and the words stuck with me all these years. Lincoln shut his eyes, to keep back tears, so it seemed to Dr. Treffler, as he dredged up Walter Whitman's lines. "Sight at daybreak. In camp in front of the hospital tent on a stretcher, three dead men lying, each with a blanket spread over him. I lift up one and look at the young man's face, calm and yellow. 'Tis strange. Young man, I think this face of yours the face of my dead Christ." Lincoln, drained of arrogance, looked at Dr. Treffler as he recited in a sing-song whisper, "A woman, a dog, a walnut tree. The more you beat 'em." I can't recall the rest. "I believe you, Lincoln. I can see that you really were at Fredericksburg." When he just sat there, his chin on his chest, breathing unevenly, she said, "Shalimar." "What?" "That's the name of the perfume I'm wearing. Shalimar."
1994. Bernice Treffler loses a patient. Dr. Treffler turned around the statue of Nathaniel Hale outside the Central Intelligence Agency's headquarters at Langley, Virginia, studying the expression on the face of the young colonial spy from various angles, trying to imagine what might have been going through his mind as he was being led to execution. It occurred to her that nothing had been going through his mind. Perhaps he had been too distracted by the lump in his throat, which is called fear, to think clearly. She couldn't remember if Nathan had seen the elephant, though the term probably didn't come into use until the Civil War, before he set off on his mission behind British lines in Manhattan Island. She wondered if the British executioners wore striped shirts, wondered, too, if they had wedged a cigarette between his lips before they hanged him on the Post Road, what today is Third Avenue in Manhattan. "It is a matter of tradition," Lincoln Dittman had remembered the executioner saying, "a man condemned to death is entitled to a last cigarette." A whey-faced young man with a laminated card pinned to the breast pocket of his three-piece suit approached.
He was the first in a long line of Americans who died spying for our country, he noted, looking up at Nathan's wrists bound by a cord behind his back. You must be Bernice Treffler. When she said, in the flesh, he asked to see her hospital identity card and driver's license and carefully matched the photos against her face. She peeled off her sunglasses to make it easier for him. Apparently satisfied, he returned the cards. I'm Carl Tripp, Mrs. Quest's executive assistant, which is a fancy name for her cat's paw. I'm sorry if we've kept you waiting. If you'll come with me... No problem, said Dr. Treffler, falling in alongside her escort. She was mesmerized by the laminated card on the suit jacket with his photo and name and ID number on it. If lightning struck him right now, right here, would she have the good sense to tear it off and send it to his next of kin? First visit to Langley? He asked as he showed his ID to the uniformed guard at the turnstile, along with the signed authorization to bring in a woman named Bernice Treffler. I'm afraid it is, she said. The guard issued a visitor's pass that expired in 1 hour and noted Dr. Treffler's name and the number of the pass in a logbook. Carl Tripp pinned the pass to the lapel of her jacket, and the two of them pushed through the turnstile and made their way down a long corridor to a bank of elevators. She started to walk into the first one that turned up, but Tripp tugged on her sleeve, holding her back. We're taking the express to the 7th floor, he whispered. Several young men relegated to the plebeian elevators eyed the well-dressed woman waiting for the patrician elevator, wondering who she might be, for the 7th floor was, in naval terminology, Admiral's Country, and outsiders went there. The elevator didn't stop at other floors, by invitation only. When the door finally opened on the 7th floor, Tripp had to walk Dr. Treffler through another security check. He led her down a battleship-gray corridor to a door marked Authorized DDO Staff Only, unlocked it with a key at the end of a chain attached to his belt, and motioned her to a seat at a crescent-shaped desk. Coffee? Tea? Diet Coke? I'm fine, thanks. Tripp disappeared, closing the door behind him. Treffler looked around, wondering if this tiny windowless cubbyhole could really be the office of someone as important as Crystal Quest, whom she had spoken to several times on the phone since she first began treating Martin Odom. A moment later, a narrow door hidden in the paneling behind the desk opened, and Mrs. Quest appeared from a larger, airier office. She was obviously a good deal older than she sounded on the phone, and wearing a pantsuit with wide lapels that did nothing to emphasize her femininity. Her hair, cropped short, looked like rusting gunmetal. I'm Crystal Quest, she announced matter-of-factly, leaning over the desk to swipe at Dr. Treffler's palm with her own, then sinking back into the wicker swivel chair. She reached into the bottom drawer of the desk and pulled out a thermos. Frozen daiquiris, she explained, producing two ordinary kitchen tumblers but filling only one of them when her visitor waved her off. So you're Bernice Treffler, she said. You sound older on the phone. And you sound younger. Sorry, I didn't mean... She laughed nervously. Heck of a way to start a conversation. No offense taken. None intended, obviously. Which brings us to Martin Odom. I sent you an interim report. Prefer to hear it from the horse's mouth. Quest flashed a twisted smile. No offense intended. Martin Odom is suffering from what we call multiple personality disorder. Dr. Treffler could hear Crystal Quest grinding slivers of ice between her molars. At the origin of this condition is a trauma, the psychiatrist continued. More often than not, a childhood trauma involving sexual abuse. The trauma short-circuits the patient's narrative memory and leads to the development of multiple personalities, each with its own memories and skills and emotions and even language abilities. Often a patient suffering from MPD switches from one personality to another when he or she comes under stress. Crystal Quest fingered a chunk of ice out of the kitchen tumbler and popped it into her mouth. Has he been able to identify the trauma? Dr. Treffler cleared her throat. The original trauma, the root cause of these multiple personalities, remains shrouded in mystery, I'm sorry to report. She could have sworn Crystal Quest looked relieved. Which is not to say that with more treatment it won't surface. I would very much like to get to the trauma, not only for the sake of the patient's mental health, but because of the medical paper I plan to write. There won't be any medical paper, Dr. Treffler. Not now, not ever. Nor will there be additional treatments. How many of these multiple personalities have you detected? Dr. Treffler made no effort to hide her disappointment. In Martin Odom's case, she replied stiffly, I've been able to identify 3 distinct alter personalities, which the patient refers to as legends, a term you will surely be familiar with.
There's Martin Odom, for starters. Then there is an Irishman named Dante Pippin. And finally, there's a Civil War historian who goes by the name of Lincoln Ditman. Any hint of a fourth legend? No. Is there a fourth legend, Mrs. Quest? Quest ignored the question. How many of these legends have you personally encountered? There is Martin Odom, of course, and at the most recent session, which took place last week, I came face to face with Lincoln Ditman. How could you be sure it was Lincoln? The person who came into my office was quite different from the Martin Odom I knew. When I realized I was confronting Lincoln Ditman and said so, he came clean. Cut to the chase. Is Martin Odom off his rocker? Should we commit him to an institution? You can have it either way, Mrs. Quest. Lincoln Ditman is certainly off his rocker, as you put it. He's convinced he was present at the Battle of Fredericksburg during the Civil War. Say the word, and I can get a dozen doctors to testify he's clinically insane. If you wanted to, you could have Lincoln Ditman, or his alter ego, the Irishman Dante Pippin, committed indefinitely. What about Martin Odom? Martin is distressed by his inability to figure out which of the three working identities is the real him. But he functions reasonably well. He is quite capable of making a living, of fending for himself, perhaps even of having a relationship with a woman, as long as she is able to live with the ambiguity at the heart of his persona. In short, nobody who meets Martin in a bar or at a dinner party would think he was mentally deranged. Dr. Treffler nodded carefully. As long as he is unable to dredge up the details of the original childhood trauma, he will remain in this state of suspended animation, functional enough to muddle through, vaguely anguished. Okay, I want you to drop this case. I'll send my man Tripp around to your clinic to collect any and all notes you might have made during the sessions. I don't need to remind you that the whole affair is classified top secret and not to be discussed with a living soul. Dr. Treffler remembered something she'd told Martin at one of their early sessions. Even if I changed the names to protect the guilty? This is not a laughing matter, Dr. Treffler. Crystal Quest stabbed at a button on the console. Tripp will see you to the lobby. Appreciate your coming by. That's it? Mrs. Quest heaved herself out of the wicker chair. That's definitely it, she agreed. Dr. Treffler rose to her feet and stood facing her, her eyes bright with discovery. You never wanted me to identify the trauma. You didn't want Martin to get well. Quest sniffed at the scent of perfume in the windowless cubbyhole. It startled her to realize that Bernice Treffler's professional psyche reeked of femaleness, which was more than she could say for herself. You're in over your head, the deputy director of operations testily informed her visitor. In Martin's case, getting well could turn out to be fatal. 1997. Martin Odom discovers the Katovsky Gambit. Stepping off the curb in front of the crowded airport terminal, Martin raised an index finger belt high to flag down one of the freelancers cruising the area in search of customers who didn't want to deal with the doctored meters on the licensed cabs. Within seconds, a battered Zill pulled up to a stop in front of him, and the passenger window wound down. Kuda, demanded the driver, an elderly gentleman wearing a thin tie and a checkered jacket with wide lapels, along with a pair of rimmed eyeglasses that were the height of fashion during the Soviet era. Do you speak English? Martin asked.
Нет, нет, не говорю по-английски, the driver insisted, and then began to speak pidgin English with obvious relish. Which whereabouts are you coming to, comrade visitor? He asked.
A village not far from Moscow named Prigorodnaya. Ever hear of it? The driver rocked his head from side to side.
Everyone over 50 knows where is Prigorodnaya, he announced. You have been there before?
No, never.
Well, it's not stubborn to find. Direction Petersburg, off the Moscow-Petersburg highway. Big shots once owned dacas there, but they are all late and lamented. Only little shots still live in Prigorodnaya.
That's me, Martin said with a tired grin. A little shot. How much?
A round trip, $100 U.S. Half now, half when you resume to Moscow.
Martin settled onto the seat next to the driver and produced 2 20s and a 10, which was what Dante Pippin had paid the Alawite prostitute Jamila in Beirut several legends back. Then, popping another aspirin from the jar he'd bought at the airport pharmacy to dull the pain from the cracked rib, he watched as the driver piloted the Zill through rush-hour traffic toward Moscow.
End of disc 8. Please continue with the next disc.